He kōna ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
We've got 2.5 hectares of land, which is sort of in the heart of Gisborne. And we have our first building, which houses the research and the clinical service and the education component of Matai. And the goal is to create a larger campus that supports medical research and innovation for New Zealand.
Kia ora, nau mai haramai ki te ao hurahanga. Hello and welcome to Our Changing World, ko Glacken Cannon tēnei. Dr. Samantha Holsworth has big ideas for what comes next for the Matai Medical Institute. She's a Gisborne local, as well as research director and chief executive at the not-for-profit institute. They've been up and running for 4 years now, first in a rented space, but as of April of this year, in a brand new building designed to house their staff and high-spec MRI machine. And some of the research happening here has been described as pioneering, groundbreaking, and world-leading. And I wanted to find out why. First, though, I meet the key piece of tech at the centre of their work.
So we are in what we call the control room in the MRI suite here at Matai. So this is where we control the machine, where we do the settings for the pictures, just where we hang out, really, while we're doing the scans.
This is Taylor Emston, one of the two MRI technologists on staff. It's a standard control room situation, much like you've seen before if you've gone in for a scan, or if, like me, you've watched heaps of medical dramas. There's a computer on the desk, there's a bunch of monitors, a big window looking into the room where the MRI machine is, and a live feed from the camera inside the scanner.
Always keeping a couple of views on whoever's in the machine at the time, so we make sure that they're, you know, doing okay while they're in the machine. We've also got the capability to do Netflix and YouTube while the patient is in there. So one of these screens in front of us now controls what the patient is watching while they're in the machine. And we can also do Spotify and the radio if they just want to listen to something and zone out a wee bit while they're in the machine, which is nice.
Maybe a nice Our Changing World episode 2? How magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, works is that it creates a strong magnetic field around you as you lie inside it. This magnetic field causes the atoms in your body to align in the same direction. Then, with the magnetic field still on, radio waves are sent from the MRI machine, and they kind of knock these atoms away from the aligned direction. When the radio waves are turned off, the atoms revert back to the aligned position, releasing a little signal as they do, which happens at different speeds depending on the atom and therefore the tissue in the body. So a computer picks up these signals and converts them into a picture. It's all quite fascinating. One of those, how did we ever think of that kind of situations? You can get different strength MRI machines related to the strength of the magnetic field they can produce, which is measured in Tesla, named after inventor and engineer Nikola Tesla. And for reference, a small bar magnet might have a magnetic field strength of about 0.01 Tesla.
This is a 3 Tesla MRI machine, which is pretty strong. It's a wee bit stronger than your fridge at home. So we have to be careful about what we take into the room itself. So we screen everybody, which means making sure that they don't have anything on or in the body that we don't want going near the machine before they go into the room. So we don't want bobby pins, we don't want belts with big steel buckles, we don't want coins in the pockets, things like that. Otherwise they risk getting sucked into the machine at a rather high speed.
Yeah, and probably don't want to be responsible for damaging this particular
Correct.
Machine.
Yeah, this one is worth a wee bit more than my salary, so I'd hate to cause any damage to this one for sure. It's a great machine to work on though. We get some, you know, some good pictures with this machine.
In New Zealand, you can find 1.5 and 3 Tesla machines. So this one is on the stronger side. Around the world, there are even stronger ones used in clinical settings and extremely strong magnetic field MRIs used in research. But these are megabucks, says Taylor. Rigged up as I am with all my recording equipment, heading near the scanner is a no-no. But there's some red tape across the door that I can stand behind as Taylor opens it up to give me a better look.
So at the moment we've got what's called a phantom. What it does is we do a warm-up in the morning to make sure that the machine is all working correctly. So we just, you know, do a little test before we get any actual people in the machine every day. So my job this morning will be to take the phantom out of the machine, get set up for our first patient, and then bring them in. We've got all sorts of straps, sponges, every possible combination that you could need. And we also put earplugs and earmuffs on the patient because the machine is very noisy.
This scanner is busy. It's used for clinical scans for local patients and to image research participants who are part of the many studies underway here. Taylor's day involves meeting these people, bringing them in here, getting them set up in the scanner, and then running the scan, which varies depending on what you're planning to image.
Each body part takes a different amount of time depending on what we're doing. Something like a knee takes about 10 minutes. If you're getting your heart scan, that's usually around 45 minutes or so, so that's a longer one. And some of our research is upwards of an hour, which is why we say it's so beneficial to have that Netflix capability in there. It does really make a difference for people who are in there. Some scans need what's called contrast medicine, which is like a dye that we put in to visualise kind of blood flow and things like that inside the body while we do the pictures. Some don't, so I have to look at my list in the morning and kind of see what we've got going on as to what I'll be doing that day. But it's an amazing job just having sort of that hands-on interaction with patients, but also just, you know, feeling like you're doing something goods, you know. I really enjoy the job and, you know, enjoy helping people feel comfortable, because a lot of people do get, you know, a little bit nervous, a little bit claustrophobic in the machine, so just being able to help them with their anxiety can actually, you know, make me feel like I've done a good job that day, which is nice.
Yeah, it's an impressive machine, but I imagine that it's very intimidating if you're sliding into that little semicircle there that's totally enclosed. If you had any kind of claustrophobia,
correct,
it would be challenging.
And would you believe it, this is what's considered a wide bore. So this is actually about 15-20 centimeters wider than a standard MRI machine. So you can think, if you're struggling with what we've got here, the older, smaller machines would be so much worse. So it's great to have this in Gisborne as well, just that little bit of extra room while you're in there.
So, what can it be used for? Well, MRI allows you to get really good 3D images of the non-bony, soft tissue parts of the body. Your brain, spinal cord, heart, blood vessels, organs, ligaments, tendons, and muscles. So in clinical settings, it's used for diagnosis of injuries and disease detection across a wide range of disorders. Researchers pushing the boundaries of what the technology can do are adding to this list all the time. And MATAI Chief Executive Dr. Samantha Holdsworth is one of those researchers.
So I did a physics degree at the University of Canterbury, initially just focused on astrophysics actually. After that, went over to Australia and did a Masters of Medical Physics, which covered different imaging modalities like MRI, CT, you know, x-rays and ultrasound, and then went off to do a PhD specialising in MRI, and then after that over to Stanford, where I was there for 11 years working first as a postdoctoral fellow and then a senior research scientist focused on translating advanced medical imaging techniques, particularly MRI brain imaging techniques, to the clinics, and then came back about 6 years ago to New Zealand.
And when you say translating to the clinics, this is like, how can we best use MRI, this medical imaging technique, to answer and solve questions around diagnosis? Mm-hmm.
Yep. So there's a couple of aspects of what I've focused on. One was, how do we go faster so we can get images much quicker, because MRI is notoriously known for being quite long compared to modalities like X-ray and CT. So one of my focuses was, how do you speed up the MRI method itself? And then there was a second component, which was how to correct for motion, because again, motion can affect the image quality. And then it was about coming up with better ways or new ways of picking up diseases earlier, using both the way you acquire the data as well as image processing techniques to help pull out different diseases. And the focus was mainly, for me, it was on brain imaging, but some of the methods we developed there were applicable to other body parts as well.
One of the things Samantha has worked on for quite a while now is a technique called amplified MRI.
What that did was used a regular, what's called a cardiac gated MRI method, which is typically used actually to image the heart, to see the dynamics and function of the heart as it beats. So we use that method on the brain, and then we coupled that resulting image with a real-world image magnification algorithm that was developed by MIT to amplify the motion of the brain as the heart beats. So that gave us a sort of a completely different way of looking at brain health.
Yes, they are looking at how the brain moves in response to a heartbeat. It's such a teeny movement to try to detect, but this technique amplifies it by 50 times. I've seen videos of this on their website, and it's quite remarkable.
So every time the heart beats, blood goes through the carotids into the brain, and it kind of moves the brain around. And that motion is around, you know, depending on where in the brain, it's around 0.1 millimetres, which is below the resolution of typical imaging. And so what we're doing is we're amplifying that so you can see it. I just want to put a disclaimer there, is that there is another method which can pick this up, but the difference here for us is that it's very, very fast. It gives you exquisite brain fluid contrast, and it uses regular images off the scanner, a regular technique off the scanner.
They're now looking at a lot of different clinical applications of using this MRI technique.
One of them is in, for example, Chiari malformation, which is when the cerebellum kind of herniates and drops down, and it blocks the flow of the fluids in the brain, and it creates this abnormal motion. So we're using it to see whether we can guide neurosurgeons as to whether they need to go into surgery or not. So that's one application. We're also using it together with computational modelling in collaboration with Auckland Bioengineering Institute to see if we can come up with a non-invasive measure of brain pressure.
And when she says non-invasive, at the moment, the only way to diagnose increased brain pressure is to drill a hole into the patient's skull. So if you could measure this pressure, which sometimes increases after head injuries, brain tumours, or meningitis, by just doing an MRI, well, I think I'd be keen on that.
Another one is we're working with Stanford around dementia, seeing if we can see abnormal brain motion patterns in dementia, concussion. There's a whole bunch of things that we're looking at.
So the technique kind of enables you to see, okay, well, in a normal brain, you've got this heartbeat and that causes this change of pressure, and we can actually see the motion happening and maybe the biomechanics of how the brain
Absolutely.
Will move.
Yeah.
But now you can also look at that in brains of people who have different disorders
yeah.
and see, okay, well, can we see this change
yeah.
in the pressure and the biomechanics?
Yeah, that's right. And if, you know, something like, for example, dementia is a area which MRI has had difficulty picking up early. You know, it's reasonably good at picking up late stage Alzheimer's, but something like dementia, is everyone's on a hunt for these early biomarkers of dementia. And so one of the projects we've got, and that's with Stanford, is looking at, you know, abnormal brain motion patterns across the brain for early stage dementia. We're also using amplified MRI in our guided brain surgery software. We're using the motion from the amplified MRI coupled with other advanced imaging and computational modelling to help guide neurosurgeons to cut tumours out with more accuracy. So that's part of a prototype we're developing as part of a company called Neurophenos that's spun out of the University of Auckland.
She started developing this technique with a colleague at Stanford, and she's worked with other researchers across the years since to improve it and expand its capabilities. But after 11 years in California, she returned to Aotearoa.
I mean, I felt that a lot of the research we're doing was wonderful because it was being translated at Stanford Hospital and other hospitals, but I think it was, for me, it was time to come home and bring that technology to benefit our community and benefit New Zealand and create something special in New Zealand using high-tech equipment and good people and, you know, bring research to work alongside a community. I think that was the big dream.
And it seems the dream is well underway, guided by the vision for Matai.
We really see Matai as three pillars. We've got our clinical service, which helps keep the lights on and provides high-tech imaging for our community. We've got our research projects, which span a number of different areas and have application locally, nationally and globally. And then we've got that education piece, which is trying to kind of grow the STEM workforce locally and in New Zealand as well.
As you've heard, Samantha's background is in brain imaging, and the Institute is involved in a number of research projects based around the technique she has developed. There are also other related brain research projects happening here. There's a study on ADHD and fidgeting, and there's a methamphetamine recovery project.
Can the brain recover from damage caused by methamphetamine use? Our guests are part of a research project that uses MRI scanning to study the impacts of meth on the brain. New Zealand is among countries with the highest use of meth globally, with wastewater data showing this is concentrated in rural towns in Northland, the Bay of Plenty and Hawke's Bay.
On top of the concussion modelling project Samantha mentioned, they're also trying to figure out a way to be able to see concussion on MRI scans.
A group of schoolboy rugby players in Gisborne are at the forefront of a study into concussion that could make its detection more speedy and accurate and help patients better manage their recovery.
This one uses an MRI technique developed by Emeritus Professor Graham Bitter, another Kiwi based overseas, who is, well, a very big deal in the field. He pioneered a lot of the early techniques to examine brains using MRI, many of which are still in use today. He was on the 2024 New Zealand Honours List for his services to medical imaging. And recently, with the Matai team, he's developed yet another new mathematical technique that can improve the contrast in images by 10 to 20 times to help with diagnosis in many brain disorders. But it's not all brains.
We have a prostate cancer pathway. We're doing this Tairawhiti study where we're imaging whole body, looking at all the different organ parts and coupling those with Auckland Bioengineering Institute's computational models. That means there's lots of different other areas that we're looking at outside the brain as well.
The Tairawhiti Child Wellbeing Study is aimed at establishing an imaging and modelling database for what the natural range of normal is, which will help improve understanding of our bodies in health and disease. While the goal of the prostate cancer project is to improve how it's diagnosed, particularly for those who live in underserved and remote communities. I asked Samantha if its community need that drives their research decisions, or is it more about who approaches them with a good idea?
I mean, the methamphetamine recovery one, that was community need. And I mean, also a lot of these things also attached with funding, right? I mean, we'd love to do a lot of things, but if we don't have the funding, we can't do them. But there's many of them where they're driven by a community need, but there's others where, you know, they come to us to say, look, we've got this problem we want to solve, and, you know, you've got the equipment and you've got the expertise. Can we run a pilot here? And so the way we evaluate those, it's going to benefit people. And it has a positive impact on our community. So, for example, if they come with internships, scholarships or opportunities for the people here, that's something we factor in. We factor in whether we, you know, obviously whether we have the expertise and to do it and to help, and the imaging that's needed to help with that question, that research question. So it's kind of holistic, it's a holistic assessment.
The internships and scholarships fit into their third pillar.
Where we feel like we can help with that STEM pipeline is around the school leavers age. So we supply school leaver scholarships to go for kids from here to go to university, and then we provide opportunities to do summer research internships while they at university, so during the summer while they're attending university. So just last year we had 23 summer research interns. This year we've got 16 coming, all local except for two, I believe.
In growing the STEM capacity in the region will be needed if they achieve their vision.
We've got this dream of creating a translational medical research and innovation campus. So we've, as you know, we're in this building now, which is on the edge of the campus, and we're looking to grow the campus into something which kind of, I guess I often think of it as like a little mini Mayo, right? So it's about bringing clinical, clinical together with engineers and scientists and researchers, together with the community, together with iwi, to come together to create an ecosystem that can drive innovation in STEM.
And when you say Mayo, you're referring to a clinical institute that's in the States.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And that's just a wonderful example of an academic research, medical research centre that has catalysed discoveries, major discoveries that can help, that benefits people, and it's been a highly successful model. But, you know, it's slightly not quite Mayo for us. It's a combination of, I guess it's like Mayo alongside community and iwi together to kind of create an ecosystem that can support medical research as well as the STEM area in general, so innovation in science and tech.
It might be surprising to many that Samantha would choose to do this in the small city of Gisborne. But for her, alongside her desire to bring her expertise home, Gisborne's size and character is actually a big advantage.
For us, being in a small community has opened up all sorts of applications because we can really genuinely work alongside the community to do the research. That interaction has not only positively benefited people here, but also the quality of the data we're getting, because we have such high retention rates for our research studies. We get absolutely pioneering and world-class data that creates really good outcomes, right? Because we got good high retention. In our concussion study, for example, our retention rate is 90%, and that's unheard of.
And when you say retention rate, that's, if you've got a long-term study, people keep
come
back in.
Yep, that's right. We've really made a real big point of building trust with our community. So we're doing research alongside our community. And so what that means is constant feedback on what we're doing, the results of the studies. And so that gives people opportunities to kind of feedback to us and be involved in the research process. That can be quite difficult to do, but being in a small community, A, it's very, very rewarding, but B, it's also the right thing to do. And so, before we have an international publication, before everyone else sees it, there's a lot of engagement with our community before. And it also lowers the barrier, I think, for young people coming through. We're not just some ivory tower that's sitting there, so kids can see that it's not that hard to be in this field. It's accessible for them. And the other thing, I think, is because, I've always seen Gisborne as a highly innovative area. I think there's a lot of innovation in rural communities and regional communities. You can move fast. Professor Graham Bidder, who's a Kiwi pioneer who's based in the UK, and he came to us with this mathematical framework he developed where we, our team was world class, our team, they were able to implement his mathematics and get it going in our scanner, and it took a couple of weeks, and normally these things would take years, and so within 3 months there was a publication on this method that was, amazing method of picking up white matter disease, right? So things just move quickly. And the other thing is around why Gisborne is that we don't, it's an unfortunate fact that we don't have as easy access to specialists, right? We want to change that, obviously, for our region, but we don't. We have limited numbers of specialists that can come. And so our way we think about it is how do we innovate in the absence of a specialist? And our innovations can then benefit not just people in rural areas and regional areas, but also could benefit and augment capabilities of clinicians in the cities as well. So it just opens up other opportunities that may not have existed in a big metropolitan area.
The research work continues, and their next big step for the campus is to try to get infrastructure funding, and if they do, they'll start building.
How many people work here right now?
We've got 17 staff, but the size of the collaborative team is over 100 people who work on, if you're spanning the projects, there's over 100 people, and they're local, national, international collaborators. Yep.
And the dream campus build will increase the size?
By a lot more. Yeah.
Thanks to Taylor Emsden, Dr. Samantha Holdsworth and Jeanette Lepper of the Maatai Medical Institute. This episode was produced by me with help from Ellen Rikers and Liz Garten. Sound engineering was by Phil Benge. We'll be following up this episode in a few weeks with a deep dive into the ADHD research happening at Maatai. Keep an eye out for that one. Learn more in the write-up for this episode at rnz.co.nz/OCW. If you've got feedback, episode suggestions, or just want to say hi, you can email us at ourchangingworld@rnz.co.nz. Te nā koe I whakarongo mai, thanks so much for listening. I'm Claire Kincannon. Have a great week. Kia pai, te wiki.